The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Good evening. A really warm welcome. Welcome for everybody. It's so nice to kind of share the Dharma. Even though it's, you know, you're not here in the room with me, I do feel kind of connected. I recognize some of the names in the chat and imagining sitting with you all. It's really lovely. So today I want to talk a little bit about the Buddha before he was awakened. I guess technically he then, before awakening, was called a bodhisattva, or Buddha to be, or maybe his given name, Gotama. Some people pronounce it Gotama. In Pali, we would say Gotama. There's this passage that talks about something that inspired him to practice, that spurred him in his practice, and it's not the usual heavenly messengers that we often think about as what caused the bodhisattva, the Buddha, to be, to leave this opulent lifestyle and go be a mendicant and finding a way towards awakening, but something else. And surprisingly, there is a little bit fear has a role in this, and kind of spurring him to practice. And so, there's some verses that the Buddha says that in response to what's happening in his contemporary time, he tells a story of what happened back before his awakening. So what's happening in the contemporary time of when the Buddha's speaking, or the tradition holds when he was speaking, according to the commentaries, which were composed hundreds, many hundreds of years, maybe even 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. So the story is, maybe it doesn't matter so much whether this is true, but the story is that there was two groups of people that were quarreling, that were fighting. One group was the Shakya clan. You might, sometimes the Buddha is called Shakya Muni. That means sage from the Shakyas. So the people of the Shakya clan were quarreling with people from the Kosaliyan clan. It's these two groups of people. And both groups had made irrigation channels on the Rohini River, which formed the border between the two regions of where these two different groups of people lived. So in one year, there was very little water. Maybe it was a drought, we might imagine. And so they were fighting over who could get the water, the irrigation channels that each group had created. They were disputing, and they were fighting and insulting each other, and just escalated and escalated until the two armies met on the two different banks of the river. So then the Buddha hears about this. His own people are fighting, and he goes and he gives a talk. And he describes how seeing people quarrel before he was awakened served as an impetus, served as a spur for his awakening. And this is captured in verses, in a poem, maybe perhaps we can think about this. And I modified the verse just a little bit to make it a little bit more cohesive for what we're doing here. So I'll read the whole excerpt, and then I'll unpack it a little bit, and we can discuss it. So it starts this way. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken, seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water. seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. So maybe we'll talk about this a little bit. So, starting at the beginning, I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. These words, dismay and shaken, are a translation of this word, samvega. Some of you might have heard of this, samvega. And Tanisaro Bhikkhu has a really nice translation of this expression of samvega. He describes it as, there's three different aspects to this. First is this, he uses this language, oppressive sense of dismay and alienation that comes with realizing the futility of life as it's normally lived. This idea of like, okay, there's more and more difficulties. There's just more difficulties coming up every day. There's something or suffering here and everywhere. Again, using suffering as this, over a big range of experiences, not only intense suffering, but maybe some, you know, mild suffering. So this oppressive sense of dismay or terror or alienation when you feel like, oh, everything is, there's difficulty everywhere, or maybe it might arise when seeing like, oh, everything's changing. There isn't a solid place to land on that's consistent and steady where we can finally rest. So that's one aspect of samvega. Another aspect is Tanisaro Bhikkhu says, a chastening sense of our own complicity, complacency, and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly. Right? When you realize, like, oh, I was not really paying attention. I was kind of thinking that if I could just have that one more thing, it was going to make me happy, or achieve yet one more goal, it was going to make me happy. And these would be lasting sources of happiness, or as soon as I have that perfect relationship, or whatever it might be. And then when we have the sense of like, you know, this hasn't been working and it's not going to work. And this sense of foolishness of thinking, I was so committed to getting these things, and yet they aren't sources of lasting happiness. So that's the second element of samvega. And then the third element is this sense of urgency, this sense of maybe this energy that arises of wanting to find a different way, wanting to practice. And kind of in the Buddhist sense, they use this word samvega for what motivated the Bodhisattva Gautama, motivated him to leave the palace, to leave that opulent lifestyle, is this sense of, okay, this looking around and, oh, this all here isn't a way towards freedom. How can I find a way to freedom? So that's samvega. So these verses start with, look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water. I will say that for me, that a number of years ago, that I had some neighbors that would regularly around 9 p.m., the yelling would start. And I couldn't quite understand what they were saying. It might not have been in a language that I understood, but nevertheless, just the yelling. And I was shaken. I was surprised by how affected I was by just overhearing other people that I didn't even know. I wasn't exactly sure which apartment it came from. But how it's really troubling. And I can see how it was I was shaken, but also I was so moved by clearly they were under a lot of distress too. And the Buddha, he describes it, seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water. That feels heartbreaking, right? Fish in little water, not being able to breathe, and feeling the desperation, doing whatever you can. And perhaps the reason why you're in little water is because you're in a puddle, or, you know, that maybe the river that used to flow readily now is having less and less water. Maybe the irrigation channels have been cut by the Shakyan people or the Kosalian people, but the fish running out of water, and like also as the people are running out of water, and there's like limited things you can do. It's very, for me, it's very evocative, this thrashing about like fish in little water, and the sense of, well, what can we do? So the thrashing about, you know, the opposite of being collected, and the opposite of taking a meditation posture, right? It's, you know, thrashing about. And then the verses continue. Seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. So it's not clear exactly what the Bodhisattva is afraid of here. Seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. So maybe just like how I described how I was felt shaken here, seeing other people quarreling, maybe he became afraid too, this unsettledness. Maybe he's concerned that the strife, the hostility, the enmity that he's seeing will spill over and he'll be affected. Maybe he's afraid because he sees that these are people that he cares about and that they will harm each other. Maybe he won't be harmed, but people that he cares about will be harmed. Maybe he's afraid that it will never end. You know, there's lots of stories of family feuds that seem to not end, or I'm sure all of us, especially these days, we can think of some different groups that just seem to be warring in so many different ways that these disputes show up, and it's really unsettling and frightening, especially if they're leaders and they're thrashing about like fish in little water. So it's interesting to see, though, or to imagine that the Bodhisattva here, he's saying that seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. This idea that maybe couldn't see a way out, couldn't see, like, well, how is this going to end if there's always some one-upmanship, or if there's some really digging in with the heels of willing to see the other's point of view, or not willing to be flexible, or to admit a person made a mistake and that maybe somebody else has a better idea, or feeling like there's no way out. So then the verses continue. And the Buddha says, describing himself when before he was awakened, then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. So it's interesting. First, he talks about what's embedded, seeing here, what's embedded in the heart. Some of you might know that the word citta can be both for mind or heart, and that's not the word that's being used here. It's actually a word that only means heart. So this arrow in the heart, right, it feels heartbreaking to even think about this, but he talks about, he's talking about seeing the conflict in them, and then he sees this arrow here in himself. So turning it around and looking at himself, this arrow hard to see, embedded in the heart. So he switched from looking at the problems out there and looking and blaming and maybe imagining what's happening or what's going to happen as a consequence of the conflict out there, and turned it around and looked at, okay, what's happening here? What's happening in my own experience? So going from blaming others to taking some responsibility, or checking in to see if there is some responsibility that he might have with that. And this idea that the arrow is hard to see, especially if you're looking out there and blaming others, or maybe if there is some fear, maybe there isn't the collectedness in order to see inside oneself or to inquire within. But the heart, this is where we would feel this samvega. This is where we would feel this spurring on to practice, the sense of urgency and of wanting to practice, feeling maybe the sense of foolishness and of being complicit and thinking that other things are going to be a source of lasting happiness. So he says that, then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. So again, then speaking about all people, recognizing that what he saw in himself is part of just the human experience, and that all of us have this experience that when we're pierced by this arrow, we dash about in all directions. So this arrow represents this, the piercing sting of things that or lead to us to thrash about or dash about. The commentaries give a whole long list. Something we can think about is some greed, hatred, and delusion, these unwholesome roots of our behavior. Also is this conceit, kind of like a Buddhist conceit, which is not only thinking that you're superior to others, but thinking that you're inferior to others, as well as thinking that you're the same to others. So a conceit in the Buddhist understanding of it is having a strong sense of self, I'm over here, a strong sense of you are over there, and then to compare. And to be really overly concerned with that comparison. Am I doing better? Am I doing worse? Do I have more? Do I have less? Oh, or we're just the same. But to be always making those comparisons. That's how we understand the word conceit here. So this excess of self-concern, and including some pride or vanity or sense of self-importance that we might have. Especially when we compare ourselves with others. So this is part of what the sting of the arrow is, being pierced in the heart. Also, we can understand this arrow to be views that we're really attached to, holding on to, whether these are speculative views, postulating about things that we don't know about, including metaphysical views, or maybe things that predicting what's going to happen, but then getting really attached to our predictions and somehow convinced that about what's going to happen. Or views about a self. I'm like this. I have been in the past. I'll always be this way in the future. I'm like this. I'm a person who can't get settled for a meditation. I'm a person who's always sad. Or I'm a person who can never have greater and greater levels of freedom. All these views that we have about ourselves, or what it's like to be this version of ourselves right now. So these are all the darts, these are all the arrows that are hard to see but embedded in the heart, that the Buddha saw before he was awakened. He saw that these different ways of that we can get tripped up, or there can the sting of the arrow, maybe it's like a constriction, a pinching, a contraction. It's a little bit of feeling uncomfortable. And then this verse says that they talks about the consequences of having this arrow in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. We could understand dashed about in all directions in a number of different ways. And maybe we can think about it literally and metaphorically. So, right, if we have greed, hatred, and delusion, or we have speculative views or sense of conceit, these are things that kind of can create the conditions in which people will behave unethically. So to dash about in all directions can be to go astray and to behave in a way that's unwholesome, unskillful, unhelpful. For example, we could say the commentaries have this example that when they are struck by the arrow of greed, they kill living beings, take what is not given, break into houses, plunders, commits banditry, ambushes highways, commits adultery, and speaks falsely. This is a pretty scary list. But having this greed, this sense of I have to have more and more, probably we're not doing these things, but what are some of the ways in which this greed might show up and undermine our best behavior and influence us to do things that aren't skillful, aren't helpful? And the commentary continues saying that also that struck by the arrow of greed, people may go on big journeys trying to find wealth and to enduring these terrible hardships to either maybe find different jobs or maybe to commit banditry or on the highways, but you know, like to literally move about in all directions. And then the commentary says, and then if one does not obtain wealth, then they experience pain and dejection, right? The difficulties if you're out, if you have a lot of greed and feel like you have to have more and more, and you're unable to get more and more, feeling the piercing of that arrow. And then, but if you are able to get more and more, but yet you have a lot of greed, then there's this discomfort of always having to guard and protect the whatever it is you've accumulated. I know I've certainly had that experience of feeling like I really desperately wanted something. And then I remember this back, I guess I was in my late 20s, that, you know, just starting my working career or having some income, and then buying something that was a little bit out of my price range that I, you know, really stretched myself in order to purchase. Wow, I'll never forget this. Just how I just became a little bit obsessed with protecting this object because it was so, I couldn't really afford it, and it ended up being it was a good lesson for me to how it took so much psychic energy as well as so much literal energy to be protecting something that I felt was I couldn't quote it. I just had so much greed associated with it in some particular way. Maybe there's something, you have a story like this too. But also there could be struck by the arrow of views. We might think that, maybe like the Bodhisattva before he was awakened, the story is that he did a lot of self-mortification practices, you know, starvation, or there's a number of different practices that he did. So seeing this arrow stuck in the heart, this arrow is these things that are pinching or piercing and uncomfortable and are the roots of unwholesome behavior. And then the verses continue, when the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. So we can understand they don't run as people aren't dashing about in all directions, literally or figuratively, aren't behaving unethically or doing things that are unhelpful or unwise, and don't sink. We can understand this as they're able to cross over the floods. They're able to get over to the far shore. Some of you might be familiar with the simile of the raft, you know, where the raft is for the purpose of taking one to the further shore, and the Dharma is considered the raft. So to not sink is to not get stuck in the floods of water. Sometimes the floods are talking about this attachment to sensuality or attachment to views or some or ignorance or attachment to more and more becoming. So when the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. So I feel motivated by this, these verses, just the Buddha recognizing that he had fear. He was spurred by seeing conflict. And he had some samvega, this sense of urgency for practice. And that he turned around and saw that there were arrows in his heart, and saw that when there's arrows in anybody's heart, they dash about in all directions. But when the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. Then maybe I should say there's a number of different, there's further verses in this poem, and it's about trainings, about how to pull out the arrow, or what it is like when the arrow is pulled out. So maybe I'll just close with one more time with this verse. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken, seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water. Seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. So may you, when you find yourself seeing others in conflict, may that be support you in your practice. Support you to look and see if there's something inside of you that you can do to help you find some more ease or some more calm in the midst of a whole bunch of conflict when you're seeing others be in conflict. And maybe be reminded that the Bodhisattva, before he was awakened, he was disturbed, he was troubled by seeing people in conflict. And he used this to help support his practice, which then helped him support other people. So in the same way, might we be spurred to practice by seeing conflict, and might we be able to help others. Thank you.